Thank you, John. So I'll be talking about excess low frequency flux noise, and what I want to try to emphasize is some of the more unusual behavior that we observed, and in particular this unusual behavior happens below 1 Kelvin. And this was done by myself, Christian Urbina, and John Clark, and it's been done many years ago, or was done many years ago. So I'll try to give a brief introduction to one of our flux noise, describe some of the experimental details, not too many, and then go over some of the basic things that we found about it, some of the unusual properties. I probably will not have time to go over, you know, some of the details. There's much, much more about this than I have time to talk about. You know, for example, I have some slides on how we know it's really a flux noise and not some other type of noise, how we know how hot the system really is, you know, checked some of the properties of it. If I have time, I'll go into this. If not, and then I'll try to finish with some conclusions. So the data I'll show you is very old. It's more than 20 years old. But what's really happened was there's been a revival of interest in flux noise. And what I think really got this going, or one of the main things that got this going, was some results from the NEC group. This is work on a flux qubit by Nakamura. This is one of his slides. It shows here a Rabi oscillation, or actually a Ramsey oscillation. And you can see that there's some decay time here, and that time is 2 microseconds. Here's a T1 with 4 microseconds. It's a pretty good qubit. And what they found, and this was described in a couple of the talks, I think, earlier this morning, at least in part, was that if you looked at the dephasing rate in this device, we'll just focus on this plot right here, as you change the bias in the device, they saw that the dephasing rate increased rapidly away from this point right here, which is a half a flux quantum in their flux qubit. This is called the sweet spot. It's the place where the device is insensitive to flux noise. And this scaling where you see the dephasing rate increasing is just what you'd expect if there was randomly fluctuating fluxes in the device. And so their conclusion was that we have flux noise in our flux qubit, and its magnitude is of the order of 1 microflux quantum per root hertz, or a microflux quantum amplitude at 1 hertz. It's not a charge noise, not critical current noise, but truly a flux noise. And the thing that still astounds me to this day is that they recognized that this noise had been seen before, and they knew the proper reference, which was very obscure since it was 20 years roughly previous to that. So I had measured a number of devices, which I'll be telling you about, and in 87 we reported what the flux noise does as a function of temperature, and I'll have much more to say about what this plot is, but we looked at here about 10 squids, or roughly that number, and as we cool down, we would see that the noise, typically you see these curves are going up, they would go up and saturate, that the flux noise would increase and level off. It didn't depend too much on the squids here, which varied greatly in size, and also the materials were there. Anyway, I'll have much more to say about this. But that restarted interest. This is another slide from Nakamura, which I liked because it emphasizes that these different types of noise come from different places. It's not all one thing that's producing the same amount of noise. So here's Nakamura's slide of a flux qubit, which is a little ring with 3 Josephson junctions in it. And this is kind of trying to point out all the things that can go wrong, you know, that cause decoherence or energy loss in the system. So you can couple to, you can lose energy, if you will, to circuit modes. Let's see, there's charge fluctuators, which you heard about this morning. It's caused dielectric loss and two-level systems that can couple to your device. Actually, they probably should have been drawn. Oh, here they are. They're in the junction also. Let's see, you could have quasi-particles. We almost heard about that in Frank Wilhelm's talk this morning. And then there's some other stuff over here, maybe nuclear spins and spins on the surface of the superconductor. It's now believed that it's these spins which are causing the flux noise in the device. And as I'll show you, the behavior of these spins, although, again, they're just electrons or atoms moving around, the behavior of the noise that's created by them are very different from what's seen for the quasi-particle tunneling, charge fluctuations, or dielectric loss. It's a really, really different behavior, quite distinct and hard to understand. So I'm not really going to go through this in any kind of detail because it's fairly well known, but I'll be talking about noise, and in particular I'm talking about low frequency noise. There's excess noise at low frequencies. And when I say noise at low frequencies, I mean like typically 1 hertz, we'll be looking at spectra. And there's a standard explanation for how one gets noise at low frequencies with excess noise at low frequencies. It's due to Dutta and Horn. And the idea is that, well, here's one of our two-level systems. It's got a left and right state. And the idea is that it can hop from one side to the other. Here, actually, if we want, we could just think about this as a spin that flips from down to up. And there's some time for it to go from left to right or right to left. And we'll assume that it's thermally activated over some barrier. And in this case, since these are equally deep wells, it's going to have the same time to go from left to right or right to left. You can work through, or if you imagine putting this thing into a thermal bath, what you'd see is it would just be flipping back and forth with some random time. It's a telegraph noise. And if you take the Fourier transform of that, you can get a power spectrum, which is just a Lorentzian. It goes like 1 over 1 plus omega squared. Of course, Lorentzian is not one of ref noise. Standard picture says you just add up Lorentzians that have different roll-off frequencies. If you get, say, one Lorentzian here at 1 hertz, another one at 10 hertz, another one at 100 hertz, and you add them up, you get a pretty good representation of a 1 over ref spectrum. So by having different time constants, here's Lorentzian, you see the key thing is that switching time, that's what determines where this knee frequency is. That's what gives you 1 over ref noise. All right, and you can work through that. And again, I'm not going to go through all the detail. You can show that, say, the noise, the frequency spectrum, goes like some overall constant, which has to do with the size of the thing that's flipping back and forth. Since it's thermally activated, you end up with a temperature there, and it goes like 1 over F. And the key assumption here is kind of hidden up here. It's this idea that you're thermally activated over a barrier. And so that would mean that the time goes like some attempt frequency, or sorry, time goes like some attempt time, if you will. And then it would be e to the u over kt. You take a log of that, you can turn around and say that u is related to the time. And it says here that if I have a distribution of energies of barrier heights, which is a constant, if you just use this relationship, you can see that that's going to give you a distribution of times, the switching times, which goes like 1 over time. You plug that in, that's how you get the 1 over f here. Right, so we'll see this again in another form. Now, a couple of things here. I should back up. This, of course, implies that the noise will decrease as you cool down. There was some subsequent work actually on charge noise, which showed that if you have a two-level system and there's asymmetry in the barrier depth as well, sorry, in the well depth as well as the barrier height, if you allow any asymmetry and any height. Well, you can show actually that you get that the noise scales like t squared over f rather than t over f. That's just, again, because of an additional distribution. And that would modify this. So you could also get kt squared over f. Now, what's interesting is neither of these are seen for the flux noise. It doesn't do this. The 1 over f is not even right, as we'll see. Not exactly right. But that temperature dependence is not what you'd expect. One other slide, which I'm not going to go through in detail, and I really appreciate that these things will be available afterwards that people want to look at them, if we think of our device, what I'm looking at is noise in a squid. It's going to be a loop, and we're going to be thinking about some small fluctuator, a spin, which is going to be randomly fluctuating. I like to think about things as circuits, and I model that or think about that small spin as actually just being a little loop. It has some magnetic dipole there. Anyway, you can work through if this is a loop that's just, or a small source of magnetic fluctuations is coupled to this bigger loop. You can work through how much noise, how much flux this little thing couples into your loop. And then what this calculation does is just say, well, what if they're spread out everywhere? Here I'm imagining they're spread out everywhere in three-dimensional space. Very simple model. You can work through that the flux noise, the amount of flux, that's spectrum, if you will, is in this loop, is going to go in the end like some prefactor. The density of these three-dimensional, the number per unit volume of these fluctuating sources, something like here, I assumed it was individual electrons, so the Bohr magneton squared, and there's an overall factor of the inductance, and then the spectrum. So this is the whole point of this is this says that, well, if you make loops with different sizes, that you'd expect the noise to scale with the inductance. It should get bigger or smaller. And this, there's one other thing that's kind of missing in here, or in principle. We know that in our real devices, the noise source is not spread over everything in space. They're probably on the surfaces of the materials or the superinductor. And so you'd have to say, well, there really should be some kind of a fill factor or something in there that takes into account the fraction of the volume that's filled with the spin. Okay, so this is one of the things also which we would want to look for, though. Is there some overall geometrical scaling? And that's going to turn out to be a much more complicated answer than expected. So this is a circuit diagram of how we did the measurement. The idea is that we have a loop of superinductor, which is the thing that we're going to find the flux noise in. It's got two junctions in it. That's a squid. And squids are extremely sensitive to magnetic flux or magnetic field. So if the flux in this device changes, this device responds. And the way that we've hooked it up into the circuit is by attaching it to some coils and a little resistor here. And here I've got a bias current source. So we put current down here, it turns this device on. We say we bias it at a location where it's sensitive to flux. If the flux changes, what happens is the current through this device changes a little bit. If that current changes, well, we have a second squid over here, which it's coupled to that loop. If this current changes, well, that the flux here will change. Well, that will change the flux in this squid. So this guy keeps track of the current in this coil, which is proportional or varies with the flux in it. So this is just an amplifier. This is hooked up to a set of electronics at room temperature, which essentially feeds back a signal here, which keeps the flux constant. That's a detail. In the end, we just have an output which tells us how much actually the current varies here, and we can relate that back to how much flux change there is in the loop. And we're going to cool the whole thing down to 20 millikelvin just to make life difficult. So this is just a look at the cell that we used, get some idea physically what's involved. Here's the chip, which is a silicon chip, about 5 millimeters on the side, which had one of these squids. These are just niobium pads where I take the squid, flip it over, press it down. It's on top of a phenolic canvas, actually mount here. It's an insulator. Over here, this green stuff is just fiberglass. This is one of the three or four different types of mounts I used to try to figure out what the noise was. The rest of this cell is niobium, actually, this gray material. The second squid is hidden under here, and there's some other components, some coils, and it goes back out. What's FL, flux locked loop? It just doesn't fit on the slide, you know, if you should. That's a detail. And then this is just another look at that cell. That cell gets bolted to, basically this is just a way to pull the wires out through it. And then this is the next step in assembling the thing. It's a niobium shield tube that goes around it. We're very, very sensitive to magnetic field. We gotta make sure that the squid doesn't see just ambient stuff. And then this whole thing gets bolted to the end of the mixing chamber. And this is, you know, quite a few years ago. The mixing chambers in the old days were quite a bit smaller. It's about, it's about that small. And then all these wires are to control the squid, to put the biases on there and other things. And right, and this is, again, look at the bottom of the squid and bottom of the sample cell attached to the mixing chamber with all these wires. And around this, we put a vacuum can, another aluminum doer, two Mie metal shields to bring down the magnetic field from the Earth. It goes in a copper mesh shielded room, and it's in a second basement lab. We're trying to reach the quantum limit at about a kilohertz, and that requires knocking all the noise down. That cell that I showed you was filled with liquid helium, and we typically ran from 4K to 0.02 Kelvin. That was to make sure they got cold. That was why the helium was there. And these are shunted squids we're measuring, and typically we would run with a few picowatts of continuous power in the squid. And this was done in 84 to 87. And that's a look at what John's Clark's lab looked like. John Martinez may recognize the shielded room where they did early macroscopic quantum tunneling and energy level spectroscopy work. Notice the prominent amount of wood, you know, in the handmade gas handling system. And the dearth of computers also is remarkable. these are you know, what do you call them, XY plotters. All right, so the devices that we were building at the time were based on the old IBM process. They involved niobium oxide and lead indium, and almost everything we've heard about today, I think maybe with one exception, has been about aluminum oxide. So these are very different materials, and oddly enough, we'll see that probably doesn't make any difference, or not much difference at this level. This is an example of one of the devices I'll show you a set of measurement data on. It's got a device, it's got a section here, which is green, which is made of niobium sputtered down, and a section on top, which is lead indium. It's half and half. Those were the two materials that I could work with, and I could change how much of one or the other I put into the device. And this is a pretty large squid. It's among the largest ones we looked at, about a millimeter on the side, much larger than typical flux qubits, which are only about 1 micron or 2 micron diameter. And a whole series of steps involving deposition of different materials. We tended to use silicon monoxide rather than silicon dioxide for insulating layers. Anyway, it's not a simple fabrication. It's about roughly 4 or 5 layers. So here's a first look at flux noise spectrum in this device, actually two spectra, at 4K, the upper plot, and at 2K. And here I'm plotting the flux noise power spectrum in units of microflux quantum per root hertz, and then the whole thing squared. So if I see it here 100, that means that that's 10 microflux quantum per hertz. And then here I'm going not gigahertz or megahertz, but hertz. It really did hurt to measure this, so to speak. But anyway, this was 0.1 hertz, and there is some data below that. It's just and up to about 10 kilohertz. And above this, that flux lock loop that we used in measurement didn't work so well. You got extra noise. And so there's two or three things to point out here. The one over F noise is this part right here, that as the frequency increases, the noise decreases. And there's some stuff up here, which is the white noise. And this is kind of how John Clark originally sold the idea to me. It was known that the noise decreased as you cool down from 4K to actually to about 1K. And indeed, in this case, the white noise goes down and the 1 over F noise goes down. And that was the way it should be. Unfortunately, first device we measured, that's where it stopped. Here's at 0.95K, and you couldn't really tell because I just flashed it. But notice it's back up to around 100 there. I'll show you all of them, but see, that's the same as it was at 4K. It went back up. And then there's 0.75K, it's a little higher, 0.51, a little higher, 0.26, about the same, 0.12, about the same. All right, it's bouncing around a little bit. There's 0.024, 0.22. Now, when I'm saying the same, I'm saying this stuff here. You'll notice on this end, the noise has gone down a lot. That was the white noise, which started somewhere, I don't know, somewhere up here. It just worked its way down progressively. But now what you see is, yes? How do I know the peaks are so broad? Ah, you're looking at the peaks. Okay, yeah. So this peak right here, that's 60 hertz. All right, that's it's like I know the how do I get the maximum? Yeah. Well, let me give you a little bit of historical facts. This data is now it's like 20 plus years old, and to convert it from the form it was in to the form that I'm showing you, I had to throw a few points out. And so I typically took spectra at actually I think the top frequency here was actually you can kind of see it here is 25 hertz. And then I take 256 points, so every tenth of a hertz. And then I go out to 250 hertz, and I take 256 points, et cetera. Now, that data is potentially still available if someone has an HPIB computer that runs 1980 operating system. But what I have is printouts. I have a finite set of data. And so I printed out, many years ago, all this data, some subset of it, including the value at 60 hertz. Yeah. So it's really much, much sharper than this is the answer.
My question was not any judgment on the data. My question was you compare maxima. Like you have in this range practically only one point.
Yeah, so what
I can't be sure that
what I would say is ignore this point because it's just 60 hertz. Okay. Yeah, so that's just the line noise. If I was in Europe it'd be 50 hertz, right? It's just a little bit of pickup, and actually this is maybe, I don't know, a few thousand H bars of 60 hertz getting in there. It's not a lot. And there's some other stuff up here, which is also just acoustical noise from the parts. This thing is really, really sensitive. Down here is maybe a few H bar worth of energy sensitivity in the thing at a kilohertz. So these, you're going to pick up everything. And so the key thing we're focusing on here actually is this background, background noise, which has actually grown up as the white noise has shrunk down. And here's just a summary of all of it. It's hard to understand what it does in the full plots. This just shows at the high frequencies, the white noise just pulls down. You can see these 60 hertz peaks or acoustical peaks just kind of stick around. I think this is a mechanical pump maybe. And then here it's hard to see what's going on, but it first comes down and then it goes back up. That was this behavior I saw. So the way we typically characterize the noise is we pick off, say, what happens at 1 hertz, and we just say, what is the magnitude at 1 hertz? And here's what that looks like. And this was bad news, at the time. I remember seeing this the first time, and this is not going to be an easy thesis. So at 4K to, here's at 2K, you see it came down. It was supposed to just keep on going. And below that, there's at 0.95 was higher. It came up and rattled around. Here's a point at 24 and 22 millik, some significant difference. So this is the first bizarre thing about the noise. It gets worse as you cool down. And something happens, in this range here. I don't want to make any such argument. I will show you some things where the noise does vary with temperature, though. And so there is the temperature is some kind of a knob there, but it's a really good point. If I knew what the system was that was doing this for sure, well, then maybe I could make some argument about it. But since I at the time, certainly I didn't have any idea. But you're absolutely right. Yeah. Who knows what the temperature is? Maybe we're stuck at 1 Kelvin, right? Okay. So here's we measured a number of devices. Here's a close relative, which we actually didn't publish anything on, the one of ref noise, for a long time. It looks just like it, except it has these big masses of this is gold copper. Those are cooling fins to get the electron temperature down, because remember, we put power through here and we're running at 20 millik. It turns out that that's a pretty big effect in these devices, that even if it's only a few picowatts, at 20 millik, it's very hard to cool the electrons. They only emit via phonons. So by adding a big chunk of metal here, you just say I'm giving it more electrons to allow it to cool. But on the other hand, from the flux noise point of view, here's what it did, or here's what they did. Now, this is now four devices. There's some of them which did, two of them which did not have the shunts, and two of them which did. And you can see that, different things are happening up here, but below, they're now ranging between something like maybe, 18-ish, to 12, but they're doing something pretty similar. It's not identical, it's not all the same, but these are four quite similar devices that are doing the same darn thing. And believe me, I had something that didn't do this, I'd show you that, because it would have been much easier. So this says that, similar devices, in this case, do similar things, and there's probably like 2 or 3 years between the first of these and the last. We kept measuring devices. This is called desperation. If the first thing didn't work, you'd try something else, I don't know. So here's one where I cut away the, I say, gosh, look at all that niobium, it's horrible. So I cut away, the line width here to make something thin like that, And then over here, I got some guys which are a bunch of little loops all stacked together. You can think of these as kind of like intermediate sized devices. Okay, how do they do? Okay, well, oops, oh, here's that intermediate sized one. Just a pretty picture I found. Get more things here. So here is, let's see, P1, that one with all the little loops, that's this guy right here. He's somewhere just in the middle of it. Here's that K1 one where the lines were all cut away. It's there. Okay, well, we got a little bit more range, but it's doing something. All right, well, didn't do it. Let's try making them smaller. We'll build, we'll just keep building, right? I'm still using niobium lead indium. Here is now the scale is 100 microns. Let me point out, the center holes on these are 100 microns. This is about a 20 micron center hole. Mostly that's blue, so that's our purplish. That's the lead indium, mostly lead indium. And fairly small. Here's another device where it's mostly niobium around the outside, and it's only a roughly 2 micron loop. So between these, they have about the same outer diameter. This one's got a bigger inner diameter, et cetera. There's some, it's hard to do geometry in some kind of systematic way. All right, well, that's as bad as it gets. I'm not going to throw any more devices at you. This is now those 10 devices, and you can see now it's fanning out between whatever, I call it roughly 12 plus or minus 6. And if you think about it, that's a couple of orders of magnitude or more difference in the area of these devices, and the noise has not changed all that much. It says it's not a magnetic field that's fluctuating, which would have scaled many more orders of magnitude. Actually, this one with the narrowest line width is a device here. It's run fairly early. We only got down to about 100 millik. So 2 micron line width did something different. And then this is the smallest device with the smallest center hole. It's at the bottom, actually. And the other next smallest device is this green one here. So smaller devices tend to end up on the bottom, less noise, and larger devices on top there. There is also this stuff that's going on at high temperature, and I want to emphasize that that's very different than below 1K. So high temperature means 1K or higher. In fact, these devices down here at the lowest end tended to have lead in them. And mostly lead, I should say. Whereas like this device F1, that little 2 micron loop was all niobium. It tends to have, if it's got more niobium, it tends to have more noise at high temperatures. Low temperatures, none of that seemed to matter. So materials effects certainly were present above 1K, but below 1K, whether I had more or less niobium or lead indium didn't make any difference. There are a couple of other devices here, which I didn't highlight and I should have, which we made on Sapphire. Let's see, it's like this one right here. This device is right in the middle of all that noise plot. It was built on Sapphire. And this one here, this K device I showed a bit earlier, that was also built on Sapphire. All the other ones were on either oxidized silicon or just bare silicon wafers. And again, that didn't matter. Those, if you hunt those devices down, they're just somewhere in the middle here. They didn't make the noise go away. So doing more or less niobium or lead indium didn't matter. Doing different substrates didn't matter. And actually, it turned out just about everything else I did didn't matter either. It was very hard to get anything that made any difference to this noise. In other words, get rid of it. That was darn puzzling. Although there is obviously some kind of size dependence here. Now, more recently, I've been thinking about some connections with actually some of the work that we heard earlier, which is how much loss you get in these devices. And this is just a couple of slides that say, okay, well, you measured some noise. Can you tell me something other than noise about the, you know, some other way to think about this? And one way is to try to do it in terms of a loss tangent. Here, since we're measuring magnetic noise, we can think of it as a magnetic loss tangent. In the morning, we heard about, you know, dielectric loss tangents or electric loss tangents. So basically, if there's noise, there's dissipation. You can work through, let's see, in the case of a magnetic loss tangent, you can say, well, you have a loop, an inductor. It's got some inductance, and I'm gonna say that it has a real and imaginary part, the permeability, and that means that in the end I'll get a real inductance and a resistance. You can work through what that gets you for the flux noise if you believe the fluctuation dissipation theorem. I'm in the classical limit since I'm at 1 hertz. You get some expression that depends on the loss tangent. Go the wrong way, here we go, go the right way, just clean that up. If you're in the limit of very small losses, which we are, you can just hold that the flux noise again goes like the temperature over the frequency, that's straight out of the fluctuation dissipation theorem at the 1 hertz limit, and then times the magnetic loss tangent. And you can, that says that if you measure the flux noise, you can construct, and you know the temperature and the inductance, you can construct the magnetic loss tangent. So here's a look at the magnetic loss tangent at 1 hertz. It's kind of a crazy thing, versus temperature. And because of this temperature down here, notice that the loss is increasing as you cool down. The noise was flat, right? But you see there's a 1 over T here, so that produces, so that says more loss at low temperature as you cool down. Not flat loss, but increasing loss as you cool down. There's also, you see that perhaps that there's a band here, which is maybe less than order of magnitude difference between all these devices. That's pretty good, because we had to square up that flux noise here. So this, and you see it also has that L in it. That's part of, this is saying that we might have partial scaling with L, that larger and smaller loops do tend to cluster together. You know, this is kind of a figure of merit that takes out some of the geometry, not all of it. It doesn't have anything to do with, it doesn't really fix up anything to do with different details of where the sources are. The other thing is, which is kind of interesting, is that this is at 1 hertz. You say, well, big deal. Now, if the if this noise was 1/f, if the flux noise went like 1/f, then these two terms would be frequency, the whole thing would be frequency independent. So if we have 1/f noise, that says that our loss tangent doesn't matter whether you measure it at 1 hertz or a gigahertz. Now at a gigahertz, a 10^-5 loss would be directly measurable in a high Q thin film resonator. So this result here is telling us something. If we know a little bit about losses in resonators, it says that if we extrapolate this, if this actually, this is 1/f noise actually extrapolated up to gigahertz, it's not consistent with the mother measurements. By the time we get to 5 gigahertz, we can't have this magnetic noise or this magnetic loss turn on. Something must happen between there. I'd also like to point out that the scale here, or the power at which we've measured this, is we're just using the thermal fluctuations to measure. We're measuring noise. The typical voltages that we're inducing in this device are like a few femtovolts or something. We're really on a low power, you know, side of things, right? So what am I looking at, John?
4 minutes.
Okay. Okay. So the other thing is, I wanted to pick one of the devices, and now talk about none of this. This stuff is not so puzzling yet. Now is the really puzzling part, which is, you know, why it was so puzzling. We never really tried to emphasize it before this point. So here's a device where it's, you know, it's got this 2 micron roughly line width, or maybe a bit wider. Looking at this picture, here's what the 2 spectra looked like. The large device, I showed you some data on a similar one, it's falling off, I'm going to say like 1/f, but when you actually fit it, you get it goes like 1/f to the sum exponent, and that exponent is about 0.92, not 1, but it's pretty close to 1. Good enough for government work, as you say. This device here, which was, you know, this is 10 times smaller diameter, so it's not really drawn to size, is shown here. You can see that the slope is quite a bit lower, and a fit gives about 0.67, so it's 1/f to the 0.67. That's a long way from 1 for 1/f noise. The other thing I could point out, other than these 60 hertz peaks, which are kind of, because I didn't draw the lines in, you can't really see that well, it's pretty darn smooth. There's not a lot of structure here. It's hard to see those, you know, you're supposed to be building this up out of Lorentzian picture according to Dud and Horn. It's hard to see any of that. These lines that are going through here are actually the fits, the dashed or solid lines. But what I want to point out, though, is these differences in the slopes. Yes? Yeah, so this is, so the dashed line and the solid line that are going through these points, first of all, I ignore the 60 hertz and the acoustics. I can't, these peaks that are in here. And then I just fit to a constant divided by F raised to the alpha. So 1 over F to the alpha noise. The constant is what I showed you before. That's the noise at 1 hertz. And then I'm adding on this constant C, which is just the white noise level. See, what I was really, I really didn't want to study this stuff at all. I really just wanted to get that white noise down to one, you know, the 1 H bar or something. But anyway, and so what I showed you before was how the amplitude varied with temperature. And now I want to show you how the alphas varied. Clearly, it depends on these two devices were different. Okay, so here's this crazy plot, which, all right, what do we got? We got alphas, which, you know, if it was 1 over F to the 1, we'd be all right up here. And versus now temperature. Of course, we know to ignore this, what's going on above 1K, because that's some material dependent thing, which I'm not saying that we understand it, but it's maybe more understandable. And then at low temperatures, you see that it's doing something rather strange here. These set of devices up here, which are between 0.9 and 1, those are those four largest devices, the 1 millimeter ones. And if it had just stopped there, that would be fine. You see, it's a little bit different than 1. This device with right here, this orange one, is the device with the smallest center hole that I pointed out before that had the lowest magnitude. And you can see it gets down to, you know, in this range, something like 0.4, and then it rises up to 0.6. And then everything else is somewhere in the middle around 0.6, 0.7. Very, very strange. It says that the slope of the noise depends on the geometry. And that's really, really hard to think about. If you thought that if you had a big device, you could just add up all the noise from the individual sources and get the result, it must not be true, because if I take a little piece of that, I should get the same spectrum as I got when I added them up. Well, you can kind of see there's a whole bunch of measurements here. So there's bouncing around, you know, a fair amount. You know, you can say comfortably between 0.9 and 1, you know, and if you go through between multiple devices, right? You can also kind of get some judgment of that. I'm almost, okay, all right. So just by kind of looking at the spectrum, you realize, gee, you know, that's pretty clean. You know, it's nice, well-fit data other than the 60 hertz stuff. And that's kind of shocking. Usually there's a bunch of bumps in the spectrum, you know, for like charge noise or critical current noise, and that's not true here. So I see John is flashing. I got as far as I got. I wanted to try one other thing, but I don't have time to do it, which is how you do it, and I won't get to the how we know this and critical current noise, all the things that it isn't and how we know them, temperature, this flash. We measured a bunch of devices. These are parameters of those devices. Other people have now reported, and we'll hear in Rob's talk some more data as well. This is a result by Cam Moeller, which was just published in RSI a couple of years ago. Flux noise spectrum versus frequency, 1 over F to the 0.7. Okay, and this is a niobium device. Do one more. This is this report now, which is maybe 2 weeks old from the Applied Superconductivity Conference. Another device out of PTB by Dimer Drung with, at 310 millik. That's the blue curve, an alpha of 0.7 again. So 0.7s were pretty common for no reason that's clear. And here's my conclusions. We've measured flux noise. It's smooth and featureless, except maybe, actually I didn't show this, but there may be some features around 0.7. It doesn't seem to depend on the materials. I think maybe Rob will show us some now new results that do, but we fully believe it comes from those materials. It doesn't behave at all like excess charge or critical current noise. It tends to increase or can increase as T decreases below 1K. We don't really understand why that happens. It may level out, at least for the range of devices I looked at in this range. It's now believed for smaller devices, it gets smaller than this by a good deal. And it depends weakly on the squid area. It can't be field noise and implies a significant loss tangent if it went up to gigahertz. And the slope of this noise is very hard to understand since it depends on the geometry of the device. So a lot of puzzles in this noise and a lot of things we really do not understand about it. And I have to say this geometrical dependence, this changing of the slope with the geometry was one of the things where you really had to say, does this make any sense at all? And until I saw many years later other people's data, someone else measured it, I really never really, you know, knew there wasn't something funny going on. So it's been very, very good to see other groups coming out with flux noise data that show similarly bizarre things. You know, share the pain is my feeling. All right, so thank you.
How can I
Please, how can I interpret the second part of your second statement, but comes from them?
Okay, so does not depend on materials, but comes from them. So I don't believe it's like, you know, some intrinsic fluctuation of the vacuum or something like that. I don't think it's the dynamics of the squid. I think that the noise source is in the materials. But, you know, I've changed around the materials and I haven't had any impact on it, right? So it has to be, and there are some theoretical explanations for this now, and maybe Rob will say some of this. But this is the theorist over here, I think on this side mostly, or maybe some over there. I'd stay away from the theory. So it's believed that, you know, they're formed at the interface between the metal and whatever, the insulator. And if we didn't have materials, of course, we wouldn't have a squid, and we also wouldn't have the noise. You know, I don't know if it makes any sense.
Yeah. Your data reminded me about something we have seen in our lab a couple of years ago and we never understood. And this was, we are doing measurements on paramagnetic samples which we put inside a squid loop. I mean, this just one example is gold which is doped with erbium.
Yeah.
And the striking thing is that you see a 1 over F noise, which is temperature independent. Mm-hmm. And in our case, it was between 4 Kelvin and 20 millikelvin. Mm-hmm. So it's completely temperature independent. It depends weakly on the spin concentration, mm-hmm. square root of the spin density or something like that. If you remove the paramagnetic sample, this 1 over F noise is gone.
That's fantastic.
I mean,
it's
basically a small 1 over F noise from the squid then, but it really adds a lot of noise in our devices. Unfortunately, because we would like to have something without this 1 over F noise. This is used to measure energy, basically particle detector. Yeah? But it's striking. I never understood how non-thermally driven 1 over F noise can exist, and I see something very similar in your case here. Yeah?
So I just want to mark how fantastic that is to actually have a sample of the stuff. See, here I could never lay my hands on the thing that was causing it. You actually have some of it. So, you know, that's a well-identified material. That's, you know, very interesting. Did you publish that work?
We've shown it at several conferences. We have published, but there's no explanation. I don't have an explanation for that.
All right.
So you didn't get a chance to show 1/2 to the 3rd?
No, I didn't. I had some slides.
Maybe we could see that now. I'm interested.
What I was going to argue, or what I had, was an argument which I actually was, you know, I was going to take out anyway. But at this morning's talk, there was a nice thing that kind of fit right into it. So what I wanted to say was, how is it you could get something? And this is not really an explanation. It's like a pseudo explanation, maybe. Of how could you get something like a 1/2 to the 2/3 spectrum? And it goes back to how you get a 1/2 spectrum. Here I'm going to assume that there's two states. I don't think I really need to assume that they're asymmetric. But anyway, if I assume that the lifetime to go from left to right or right to left, when it's like some constant divided by F to the 3. Now, what's that big F? The big F is some unknown parameter. I have no idea what it is. Except actually in his morning's talk, right there. there was a factor that went, I think, just like that. But anyway, if I had a lifetime that went some factor cubed, and then I'm going to assume down here, I'll just assume that the probability of getting a certain F, that the distribution of those F is uniform. That works out, and you just turn the crank on it. So I got lifetimes go like 1/2 to the cube. You turn the crank on it, and that gives you, That gives you, when you work it all the way through, that gives you 1/2 to the 2/3 noise. So what I asked him after his talk was, what about that? You know, have you got anything that goes like something over the cube? And he had something. I think it was the energy or the frequency of the device. So there are ways that you can construct it. Now, is this really right or not? I don't think so. I don't, you know. But anyway, changing around the lifetimes, the switching times is what does it, getting a particular distribution. So you'll be able to see those slides, I think, yeah.
Hello. Your magnetic loss was supposed to go as 1/T. Does it?
Let's see if I can find that. Does it or doesn't? Did you say doesn't or does it?
Well, it looks like it goes up by more than three orders of magnitude in two orders in temperature.
See, one, two, three. Yeah. You know, up here, of course, you know, there's all kinds of funny things happening with it.
Sure. If anything, that will make the slope smaller. It looks like it's clearly going faster than 1 over 3.
I'll check it. I hear you. It's going up, though. Yeah, so the... I you know, respectfully, I can make mistakes. I fully believe that. But this is roughly independent of temperature, at least in the big devices, right? And then the small ones, actually, it's increasing with temperature. But anyway, and then, of course, this gives us a 1 over T. So at least we expect 1 over T. And I think it's a really good comment. I'm going to check it, right? I've certainly made enough mistakes in Excel spreadsheets to know.
So you mentioned that there was a difference in the slope of the power spectrum.
Yes.
That the slope of the power spectrum depended on the geometry of the loop. So were you able to look at the distribution of the noise to see if that had a dependence on the geometry also?
Sorry, you mean the distribution of the noise, you mean the amplitude?
So I assume it's Gaussian distributed noise.
Yeah, so I did not look very often at the distribution of the amplitudes of the noise. In the times that I did check, it was Gaussian. Uh-huh. I'd have to look back and see whether I can say anything about that, you know, whether the different geometries. It was one of these questions that after a while you start, you know, doing all these reality checks, like, you know, does this make any sense? You know, what's going on? And so this was one of those reality checks where I checked the amplitudes. And hiding somewhere in this set of slides back here was an example where we looked at the, you know, distribution of amplitudes, this guy. And there just wasn't any, it was just featureless.
And that didn't have any dependence on the geometry?
That I would not be able to say. You know, I'd have to look back and see how often I did this, right, and check whether it did, in fact. I should say that I looked at enormous number of time traces over 4 years, and you know, I just watched this stuff coming out. And there wasn't any obvious signs of two-level systems ever in this data or anything that would strike you as being. In fact, after a while, I started thinking I could recognize, you know, two-thirds noise by the time trace.
So I have a question that may turn into a comment regarding the loss tangent. When you calculate it, you look at the out-of-phase part, say, from the noise-generating component, but the in-phase part contains the complete device inductance, right?
I'm not sure. I just feed it into a spectrum analyzer, take a time trace, and it gives me out the power spectrum.
Right. So then to calculate the loss tangent, the power spectrum is related to the out-of-phase part, and the loss tangent contains the in-phase part of the inductance, and that is includes the geometric inductance of the whole device. Does that sound reasonable?
I think we're going to have to discuss that after.
Okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, I suspect if you take that out and would only look at a 1 over T-type inductance that comes from a spin susceptibility, you would get a temperature-independent loss tangent, which might maybe look a little bit puzzling. But
okay. Yeah. I think we need to discuss that. Yeah.
I have a trivial set of questions that are all related, but I'm ignorant about the field. What's your cooling protocol? Have you tried to keep a sample in the refrigerator and repeat the measurements later on, and do you see any drifts with time?
Depends what you mean by later. You know, typically we'd run for 1 to 2 weeks cold, and you know, there were cases certainly where I just wanted to know, you know, as fast as I could what was the best, you know, lowest temperature, what it did, and of course it always darn thing was noisy. But anyway, and then I'd kind of work my way up in temperature, and then I might come back down to check. So there's certainly cases where, on the scale of a week or two, where, you know, I had checks, and there wasn't anything that I ever detected where it went away, right? I don't remember what the longest I ran was. It probably was the order of a couple of months or so on the device. You know, I was hoping that, you know, the thing would quiet down or, you know, do something more reasonable. And did not ever seem to do that. Oh. Okay.
Thank you, John.